Hi, welcome to Season 2 of the Let's K-12 Better podcast. This podcast is a project between Mama Capes and her kids.
Hi!
In our podcast, we will cover a variety of subjects involving K-12 education and family life.
We will talk about the ways that parents, kids, and educators can improve K-12 education and family life.
We encourage you to join our conversation on social media using the hashtag #LetsK12Better.
Let's jump into Season 2, Episode 7 of the Let's K12 Better podcast.
Intersectionality is a term created by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw over 30 years ago to describe how race, class, gender, and other individual characteristics intersect with one another and overlap to reveal how people experience the inequities and oppression present in our society.
Lots of people have lots to say about intersectionality. Much of it is either false, divisive, or harmful. What intersectionality is attempting to do is to challenge all of us to see how our experiences differ based on what we look like, our physical ability, and how society is structured historically to support the continued investment and success of some over others. Intersectionality makes our understanding of the human experience three-dimensional, and hopefully the result is a better understanding of how inequity is tied to racial hierarchy.
So what is intersectional tech? Intersectional tech is having an intersectional view of our identities, specifically Black identities, as they show up in the digital space. Intersectional tech digs into how our identities are impacted and revealed during the gaming experience or while on social media platforms. As we look at the inequity in our society, we cannot ignore the inequities present in our technology and digital space. How does race and gender impact a marginalized person's experiences online? Dr. Kashana Gray is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication, Gender, and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She is the author of Feminism in Play, Woke Gaming, Digital Challenges to Oppression and Social Injustice, Race, Gender, and Deviance in Xbox Live, Intersectional Tech, Black Users, and Digital Gaming. I learned about Dr. Gray's work after reading her books, Feminism in Play and Woke Gaming. Most often in gaming, we think about boys and men, specifically white or Asian boys and men, but Black girls, women, and non-binary folks game too. And often their presence in online spaces is met with harassment and racism. Dr. Gray is doing research in a field that really resonates with me, cyberfeminism, which is understanding how women and femme identities show up or are interpreted in digital spaces. I love playing video games, and I love that there's research by people that look like me diving into how they feel about their place in the world from their vantage point. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
We are delighted to have Dr. Kashana Gray join us today on the podcast. Dr. Gray is an interdisciplinary, intersectional digital media scholar and assistant professor in the Department of Communication and Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Let's start by getting to know you. Can you tell us about your journey to Black cyberfeminism? What inspired you to pursue your path as a digital media scholar?
First off, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I am a huge fan of yours, just as you may be a huge fan of mine. So I'm very excited to be here. I love that question. Thank you for asking me that question. A lot of folks don't ask me about, you know, my passion around Black cyberfeminism. A lot of times the focus is always on gaming, but it's my focus and my passion around Black cyberfeminism that led me to gaming, right? So I will say, you know, my pathway was my own personal experiences of being in this body as a Black woman in spaces that weren't always intended for me, spaces that weren't designed for me and spaces where people might actively try to push me out and kick me out, right? And so what I was seeing, in graduate school, I started to like notice that the trends that we were seeing in physical spaces around, sexism and racism, that those same things were happening in the online space. Now I was a little bit shocked, right? Because during that time, I was reading a lot of scholarship, a lot of books and articles. And there was this one in particular that really caught my eye. It was scholarship around cyberfeminism. So when I was reading cyberfeminism, it had high hopes for women in digital spaces. You know, there was really this idea that on the internet, like we could be anything we wanted to be, where we didn't have to bring in our identities. We didn't have to tell people that we were a woman or that we were Black or that we were queer. You know, we didn't have to say those kinds of things. You know, we could hide those things that we couldn't really hide in physical space. Well, that sounded good, right? But I think the reality was that that's just not true for women of color in particular, right? There are some things that are just automatically emitted into these spaces. There are just some things that, you know, that I could say or I could type and that, you know, it will give away like some cultural cues as to who I am or where I'm from, or maybe, because even think about, like, for instance, like when somebody says y'all or folks, or, you know, like, you know, some people like use these certain, like this coded language to like really like, you know, they're probably Southern or they're from the Midwest. Well, the same thing happens like along the lines of gender. Oh, well, you know, this person's probably a woman or that person's probably a girl. That person's probably a boy. And the same thing also happens like with racial codes, right? Where some people, like, you know, how we speak and how we think about the world and how we interact and engage in the world, you know, those things come through. And this was in the early days. So this may be totally wild, you know, for people who are, you know, trying to make sense of like, you know, online communities in like the 90s and like early 2000s, right? You know, so during this time, a lot of these spaces were text-based. So, you know, people would just type. So it's not like, you know, you can hear how I sound. So maybe, okay, sure, I speak with standard American English, but there's some inflection in my voice to let you know, that's probably a sister right there. You know what I'm saying? So, but this was like before that era, you know, this is before the streaming era. Cause right now, let's say I can't hide who I am if I decide to put a camera onto my face and start streaming on YouTube, right? But this was like in the era where, you know, if you wanted to disclose who you were, you actually had to physically tell a person that. There was a really interesting story that, I want to be mindful of like the content, you know, I'll scale back, you know, the full story, you know, just for the sake of keeping it PG. Right. So there was this article that I remember reading in graduate school, and that article is talking about, like some text-based, communities online, like, it was chat rooms. So in this particular chat room, you know, two people are going back and forth, you know, talking about how much they adore each other and how much they care about each other. And then one of the persons said, you know, I would love to rub my hand on your beautiful vanilla skin. The person on the other end actually didn't have vanilla skin and her skin was a little more chocolate. And then she said that. She said, well, it's not really vanilla, but it's more chocolate. And so the person on the other end said, wait, you're Black? And she said, yeah, is that a problem? And then he just thought that she was being deceptive and lying all this time. And he said, you know, I thought you were a white woman. How dare you deceive me in this manner, right? That article really stuck with me, right? You know, because it really highlighted just how a lot of online spaces were constructed to be white spaces, like spaces for white people and white people only. And that really got me thinking about how differently we might use the internet, right? So for instance, knowing that story and that was just one story of many, other people shared those stories. And so then we had to like protect ourselves online to make sure that that didn't happen. Cause that's a particular level of like, you know, I would say like violence even, where you're thinking that you're safe with this person and then you're not because of the color of your skin. So you know, that just really got me thinking about, you know, what do we do when we go online? How do Black women have to protect themselves? What kinds of things do we have to hide? What do we disclose? Who do we disclose those kinds of things to? Who do we trust? So that really got my mind thinking about what is it that we do in online spaces differently. So I would say, that's part of the thing that inspired me. I'm so sorry. I'm so long-winded. I know we have a lot of
gems. You were dropping gems. And I was like, okay. Shout out to the chat rooms.
This is amazing.
Right, like mom used to be in chat rooms as a kid. So what?
Yes, absolutely. Oh my gosh. I bet you have so many stories that you can like even share as well, you know, from your own experiences too. But I remember that was early on. I was reading about that because I didn't really get online until maybe like the late 90s, like early 2000s. And I think that story was from like the early 90s, like the, and so whenever I got online in mostly like gaming context and like AIM. I don't know if you know, like the
yes.
AOL Instant Messenger, right?
Yes. High school.
Yes. Yes.
That was high school for me.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And so, you know, I grew up in a rural area, so I didn't have personal access to like the internet really. So it was when I went off to college in the early 2000s when I really, you know, started getting online a lot more. And then gaming was the thing that I did a lot. You know, we had LAN parties, like local area networks. So we weren't online, but we could connect our consoles together. And then I think Xbox went live maybe around 2004. Well, I think I went online like in 2004. And my experiences from the first time I went online was full of racist and sexist speech and hostility. Because those communities, you know, we wore headsets and microphones and we talked to one another. And so I was just fascinated because what I was mostly fascinated with was everything that I was reading, what I had read during that time. And also, actually, let me go forward just like a little bit. Let me go forward. I think it was around graduate school when I started to think about like all of my experiences, like in an academic way, right? And everything that I was reading in class couldn't make sense of what I was experiencing as a Black woman online, you know, because I was full of all this literature on cyber feminism of like, hey, you can hide your identity, you know, identity doesn't matter. All this, you know, techno determinism and, you know, where people and then people just couldn't make sense of what it meant to be Black online. You know, I didn't really get that much of that. So that's really what inspired me to pursue this. I'm like, hey, you know, these Black women are doing amazing things on MySpace. Oh my gosh, y'all probably don't even.
Yo, no, girl, I
know
MySpace.
I know what MySpace name
is.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, we learned to code because we wanted like Alicia Keys and Destiny's Child like on our pages. You know? It was or Trina. I remember having a page where I had Trina on my page one
Yo,
time.
Shout out.
But we learned to code just so we could have like glitter and music and all this stuff. And I think that's really like fascinating. And I remember during that time, my peers, my white peers, they looked down on MySpace. They thought that was like the ghettoest thing ever. And we thought it was fascinating and super cool. And then I remember asking my friend, I'm like, well, what is it that you're using? And she said, I'm on Facebook. I'm like, what? And I went to Facebook and I was like, this is whack. And
yes.
The page was just plain and white and with that blue banner. I'm like, this is corny. Who wants yes. to use Facebook?
Can I just throw a shout out to Black Planet too, being like the yes. precursor to MySpace? Because I did Black Planet, MySpace, and Facebook. Sorry to like jump in, but
no, please do jump in. Oh my gosh, yes, please jump in. No, same. Like, listen, I loved Black Planet. You couldn't tell me that we would ever be in a world without Black Planet, you know? And I know there were a few, like Mijente was one, Asian Avenue was one. So I love these cultural digital spaces that we don't talk about them at all. Facebook just came on the scene and just like took over the conversation. And I think that's a real miss. You know, I think that's a real miss culturally. That's also a real miss like academically, because we didn't archive and curate, you know, those like the experiences of folks who did amazing things like during that time. I think those things, that's really what like inspired me. To pursue the path as like a digital media scholar, because I really wanted to see, like, I get what the mainstream thing is, but I didn't care about what was popular. I could care less about Facebook. But really then, like, Facebook was just like this evil thing that was destroying this cool cultural product that we had ownership of and we could do cool, innovative things with. So I think those were the kind of, and then what really led me to like Black cyber feminism was really how, you know, people would always like think that, you know, black women have always been like the poster of like the digital divide. Like they always think that we can't do something. We don't have the certain skill set. We can't code, we can't program. And then this was just like, you know, busting all of those things, like destroying that argument. Cause here we were, you know, we found something that interested us. And then here we were doing the things that people, that just defied the odds of what people thought about us and what we could do. So that's kind of what led me to Black cyber feminism. I'm so sorry. That was like 10 minutes too long.
No, that was like perfect timing. And before she starts her second question, I just want to jump in and say, like, shout out to you and other brave pioneers who were in the digital space, because I was not, you know, I had a fear of being mistreated online, like real talk. Yeah. And so I was like, I just, you know, I would hear about things that friends would experience. And I was like, I can't put myself into that. Like, I'll fight somebody.
Right. It was awful. It was just, it was really awful. And there were no protections. Like people think that there
are
protections now. There were really no protections then, you know? And at least, you know, I'm thankful that this generation, you know, has got Twitter. So if something goes down, you know, you get right on Twitter. You tell the world, baby, what has happened to you? You know, we're going to rally around you. But there were, we were really isolated back then, you know? There were so few of us. So that's real talk, that a lot of it, we just had to protect ourselves, really, because nobody else was gonna. And it's still the same, you know, exists today. Same is true.
I thought your story was like, it made me feel like I can like relate to this a lot, because even though I don't use things like MySpace or Black Planet, I still use a lot of things that you used or use, like LAN and like for gaming. I do like a lot of like gaming, like cross platform, and I use a lot of like LAN for like a lot of games I play.
Awesome.
So I thought that was really cool that we had that like in common.
Absolutely.
And I also wanted to ask what was the impact that not only like cyber feminism, but like getting insulted or mistreated in online spaces, how did that impact your life, not only in the like online world, but how did that also impact you in the physical world?
So I want to make sure that I understand your question. You know, you're asking me that, you know, with all of the, like the negative experiences, you know, how do those kinds of things impact me like online and offline? I believe that's what you're asking, Naima.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I want to approach this like a couple ways, right? So on one hand, I'm not shocked or surprised, because I see the digital online space really as an extension of physical spaces, you know, where all of those inequalities and oppressions and institutional oppressions of racism, sexism, all those things, of course, will make their way into the online space, you know, because it's people who are behind the creation. They, you know, people are the architectures of these digital spaces that we reside in. So, of course, you know, people are going to bring their own biases into the codes and programming, even if unintentionally, you know, it's going to happen, because, you know, the core of our world is, you know, a racist, anti-Black world, right? And so I guess on one hand, I'm not shocked that this could happen. But on the other hand, I guess I see these online spaces, you know, because I'm just thinking about, you know, Amber, what you had just said about steering clear of those spaces because we weren't safe in them. And I guess that's such a true statement, but I guess I also realized that those spaces could be spaces where we could find one another and sustain each other and sustain our communities and support. And I think that's what really has happened in like why I really wanted to write about, you know, the gaming spaces, because, you know, those are spaces, first off, where we're not welcome, right? Those were not spaces created by us or for us. And so the fact that we're just even present, the fact that we stayed in gaming, the fact that I stayed in gaming, you know, I'm thinking about, there was really like a mass exodus, you know, out of so many, you know, black folks, other folks of color, you know, just this huge mass exodus outside of gaming. Once we all realized that gaming was just going to be a space that just supported, you know, white supremacy. And we get that in so many examples every day, right? But then there's also just, you know, we have the capacity and we have the ability to create private spaces and the private chats and, you know, the private rooms where we can just be with one another, right? And that's, for instance, that's how we got like Black Girl Gamers, right? Or, you know, Brown Girl Code, because it's those private spaces that just continue to grow and grow and grow and grow. And then, you know, we were able to find our people and we were able to like find one another. And so I think I have moved away from, I think I also view it a bit differently because I have a different context for physical oppressions like in my life, because I grew up in rural Kentucky. I went to school in an area called Klan Country, right? Mm-hmm. And so this were, you know, I went to school with people that had rebel flags, you know, there was actual like terrorism. Like we would have like race riots. We would have, you know, and I, you know, where the white folks would basically attack us and we have to like defend ourselves. I remember walking to the lunchroom and we'd have to go outside past like certain trailers. And this was just the area where we knew that these guys from, you know, the people who they were being groomed for the Klan, right? You know, where they would, we'd have to walk past them. And although they wouldn't hit us physically, like they would throw like food at us. Like there would be like, you know, the mashed potatoes. Like I remember going home with mashed potatoes in my hair and, you know, we'd have to just wash it out. And like, and it would just be like that kind of like, that kind of trauma and like terrorism, like on like a daily basis of like knowing that, you know, white people will pose like a threat to you like at any minute, right? Now, I only stayed in that school for a year because my mama wasn't having it. You know, she came mm-hmm. to the school, you know, she cussed everybody out. And, but she realized that there was going to be no protection for her child. And, you know, this is also like during the era of like busing, you know, this was like, you know, and people think of like busing as like, you know, something from like the 60s and the 70s. I'm like, no, in the 90s, we were being bused still. They were still, you know, doing like, you know, this busing where they were taking us out of our neighborhoods, taking us away from the protection of our elders and our village and our community and people that would care about us. So like, this was in sixth grade. So, you know, first through fifth grade, I was at a school where it was, you know, probably 50% white, 50% black, but we had like a black community. But, you know, after that, you know, I think they started to, you know, the era of like consolidating like middle schools and consolidating like school districts and stuff. And that forced us to have to, our school went away from being like a neighborhood school and it opened up. And then they redistricted, did some gerrymandering, redlining, whatever it was they did. You know, we had to go to this other school that was far away. We weren't connected to the community. The people didn't know us. All they knew is that we were just these black country rural kids that were coming to their school, you know, and it was terrible. So, but my mom, she didn't keep me in that school. So I switched schools like after that. But I think that it was, I also grew up in a town. I remember we had to, as a kid that, you know, the Klan was coming to march in our town. And, you know, we had meetings about, you know, of course, nonviolent meetings of, you know, we're not going to, they might provoke us, but, you know, we're not going to, you know, lash out like in violent ways and stuff, you know? So we had all that, kind of training and like, and so I think that it's not many people have that reality, right? That, cause that's like a reality that you would think, you know, happened, you know, it was like from the '60s, you know, our parents.
The 90s.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. This
like was, let's keep it 100. That was yesterday, everybody.
That was yesterday. Yesterday, Amber. This just happened to me as a child, just a few years ago. This was not long ago. This was happening. And so, and I think that where I wasn't shocked because I saw what the human condition could be and what it could do to others. And so I guess when I see these things, when I see the insurrection, when I see, you know, MAGA and Make America Great, when I see that, I'm like, I'm not shocked at this because this is America, because this is how it's always like been for me, you know? And I think that's where that also what prompted me to study what I did, because I was just so fascinated at how, you know, these folks who have always hidden themselves continue to hide themselves. You know, they hide behind like a Klan robes, and or they would hide behind police badges, and now they're hiding behind the screens of some app, and they're hiding, you know, and they continue to hide. So I'm just fascinated, you know, with this. I think I've gone long, far away from what you asked, Naima. I hope that answers your question. You know, because so I guess for me, that and I never I know there was some folks that, you know, criticized my work, and they tried to say that that online violence wasn't real violence, that because it doesn't compare to like the physical violence. I had to push back against that, right? Because I had to remind them, I was like, you know, there's a process that leads to like an act of violence. You have to begin the process of of marginalizing a community. You have to render them powerless. You have to, you know, say that their cultures are not valid and invalidate and dehumanize, you know, them as a population. It's only then can you justify violence that happens to them, right? So it's because all those things had happened to Black people that, you know, violence on Black people happens, or because, you know, that happened to women that we can invalidate women, and we can justify racist acts, and we justify, you know, rape culture and things like that. And those same things are just permeating like in online spaces. So in my mind, I'm like, we need to take the online space like even more serious, because gone are the days of like, you know, Jim Crow era where you can say and do whatever you want. But those things just transitioned to online spaces, you know? And so I think that it's important for us to like take those same spaces serious as we do like, you know, the physical oppressions. The online matters just as much.
That was really like, wow. You already answered like most of question two. Is there anything else you want to add, like before we move on to question three?
Okay. Let's see. Let me add a little bit of that. So question two, you know, for the readers, you know, you're asking specifically about woke gaming and feminism and play. I'm not sure if you remember much about, you know, what was happening in like the Gamergate world. But I wanted to do something because I feel like during, you know, just to give, I guess, you know, the listening audience, you know, just a reminder on what Gamergate is. Gamergate was a harassment campaign against women in the gaming world, women who were asking for more diversity, who wanted, you know, to get, you know, things related to like harassment and sexual assault, like taken seriously by, you know, people in the gaming world. And then there were just some people who just thought that women were trying to destroy gaming. I don't know how they jumped to that conclusion, but you know, this is basically, you know, a lot of masculine fragility, a lot of white masculine fragility, of these strong, you know, women who were advocating for better protections for women and for, you know, folks of color. You know, they're advocating for better jobs and stuff. So Gamergate just kind of like represents, you know, really like white masculine anxieties of, you know, the other coming into their space and trying to take their whole pie, right? And it's also, you know, rooted in like this myth of scarcity. I love talking about like the myth of scarcity, where capitalism, you know, tricks us into thinking that there is only very little, and then that there's like one piece of pie, and this one piece of pie has to be divvied up among like all these groups. And so basically, you know, it's also the notion of entitlement goes along with the myth of scarcity, you know, because we've told a group of people that they're entitled to everything. We've told this group of people that they're entitled to seats in a classroom, or they're entitled to certain jobs. And then when other people come, that it's those people who are taking that away from them, right? Not capitalist logics, right? Like, so for instance, you know, people will say like, oh, these immigrants are taking your job, right? Well, no, they're not. You know, the corporate actors, you know, the richer white men, you know, who are in control of that want to maximize their profits. So they're going to go to the people who will take less and who will, you know, who can't advocate for themselves and can't advocate for better wages and better working conditions and, you know, benefits and, you know, all those kinds of things. But then, you know, it's like the immigrant that then becomes like the scapegoat, right? You know, the same thing was happening like in the gaming world, where people looked at like women and people of color, like, they're trying to take my gaming world away. It's crazy when you talk it out. It just sounds so crazy. But you know, they were really thinking that, you know, something was being taken from them, and people who looked like us was the ones taking it. Well, we know that there are multiple pies, right? That there's not just one pie, and nobody's coming to take their pie. I'm like, hey, baby, we made our own pies. We got patty pies over here. We got plenty of pies. We got sweet potato pie. Okay, you know, we got our own. But you know, it's just like the anxieties that took over. You know, it was the same conversations that happened like with the schools, you know, with the school, you know, admissions, you know, they think that like Black kids are taking their spots, you know, and like with the jobs with immigrants, they think immigrants are taking the jobs. It's the same thing. But I think it's, I wanted woke gaming to be the thing that went away from like the negative, right? Because it was so much negativity. I wanted some people to see that there was a lot of beauty in this world, and it's a lot of beauty that Black and Indigenous and other folks of color, you know, that we're creating like in this gaming space. So that they'll know that we're not even bothered by them. Like, we're doing our own thing over here. And if they would just stay in their lane, we could stay in our lane. And like, so I guess I really just really wanted to show that we are thriving, we're surviving and thriving in these spaces. and we're just not bothered, you know, by what they're doing. So I think that was what I was hoping with woke gaming and feminism in play, to just move away from that deficit narrative and move away from, you know, the doom and gloom and move away from like all that negativity. Yeah.
That was like a really like insightful, really good like answer. I was like, wow. I don't know how to segue into our next question.
That's okay. Let's just segue into question three.
Our next question is that what impact do avatars have on gamers, and why do you think it's important to be able to play games in which your race, cultural identity, and your gender can be represented?
I love this question so much. The question of avatars, it was something that never really appeared in. I never really focused like on avatars until much later in my research and in my work, right? I think for the bulk of my early part of my career, I was just so focused on like what the human condition was, like what the actual people was experiencing, what people were experiencing with other gamers, what they were experiencing in online communities. But it was actually, you know, the people who guided me down, you know, the pathway of actually focusing more so on like, you know, representations in games, because they focused a great deal on, you know, they spent a lot of their energy thinking about, you know, hey, there are no characters that look like me, you know, hey, why are, you know, for Black women in particular, you know, why do all the characters who look like us, why do they have to become, you know, like victims of sexual violence, you know? And and I think that really got me thinking a lot more about like, you know, like representations like in games, right? But I think it's very important when we think about, so I have two questions like on avatars. I mean, I have two comments that I want to make around like avatars. So when we think about like playable like characters, there aren't that many folks in the games that look like us, right? There are not that many Black characters. And if we do have Black characters present, then a lot of them are rooted in like stereotypical manners, right? So for instance, we have the very popular GTA series, right? You know, there are, you know, Black men, Black and brown men as like drug dealers, Middle Eastern men like are always like the terrorists. I'm thinking about like the Call of Duty series, right? There's even a game called True Crime where there's Officer Kang, you know, he's an Asian man and he's a police officer. But whenever they have him like engaging like with criminals like in the gang, like what most police officers would do was pull out a gun. They have Officer Kang like doing martial arts. I'm like, you know, that's not like standard issue. But here they are just like using like that the trope of like, you know, Asian masculinity is always like the martial artist, right? With kung fu and all, you know, that whole narrative. What happened like in games was the same that happened like in movies. You know, these creators, these white creators, relied on stereotypes and tropes to basically tell the story of people of color. And I think, you know, that's changed some, right? And I think that right after like, you know, Black Lives Matter just forced everybody's hand to do better. You know, I will say that, because I'm even thinking about, you know, let's say, you know, the reemergence of like Black Lives Matter in 2014, you know, behind the death of like Mike Brown. Then we just saw like this mobilization of like people, you know, having like this, you know, this consciousness, hyper consciousness, you know, sometimes like around race. And there was like a reckoning, you know, we had, you know, for instance, like Oscar So White, where people were talking about like, hey, how come we don't get any awards? And I see they're still snubbing us. I'm just thinking about the other day. I think, you know, we got snubbed again, you know, with some of these like award shows. But anyway, but the same thing happened like in the gaming space, you know, and so that we saw the creation of, you know, an initiative called I Need Diverse Games. Tanya DePass, you know, was you know, the spearhead, you know, behind that, the founder and the director behind that. And I think like in 2016, Samantha Blackman, like she calls like 2016, like I don't think she called it. I think she was referencing something, but you know, folks were saying that was like the year of the Black gamer, where we had like these characters that went beyond stereotypes, right? On the face of, like on the surface, they weren't beyond stereotypes. So we had Mafia 3, you know, that was Lincoln Clay. This was this, you know, Vietnam veteran who returned to his home in New Orleans, like in the late 70s and, or early 70s. I think it was, you know, really like on the backs of, you know, the civil rights movement and the, you know, the Vietnam era, you know, was going and it was mobilizing. And so I thought, you know, that was a very cool story. We also had Watch Dogs 2, Marcus Holloway, I believe, you know, he's a Black hacker from the Bay Area. You know, that was like the first time that, you know, I think we saw, you know, like a Black tech kind of character, like in a video game. We have Aveline Day Grand Prix, you know, of Assassin's Creed. We had Adewale, you know, another Assassin's Creed downloadable content. Of course, you know, they weren't part of the main franchise, which is also telling another story. I won't tell that today. That's another day. But we saw like an increase in like, you know, these characters that were going away from like the stereotypical character, which is very important. But we also saw, you know, I love that you use like the word avatar, because I think it's also important that we talk about actual avatar creation. Like, you know, when folks are creating, you know, what their likeness is going to be. Now, we haven't always been afforded the ability to create our own likeness, you know, our representation, you know, for like our profile or something like that. And so, you know, I think a lot of games are like getting better at allowing us to like portray Blackness. I remember for a long time, you know, Black gamers, you know, just assumed that most of the like the avatars and the when we could customize like our own character, it was blackface, you know, where you could put, you know, pixelated.
Yes. That is the truest.
Yes, thing. Right.
No, we have a whole episode out right now about that, digital blackface and blackface. So we'll have to send you the link. Literally everything you're saying right now, we're both sitting here like eyes wide open, like, oh my God, was she at the kitchen table with us?
Oh, please send that to me. I would have loved being in on that conversation with y'all. But it's
we can true. Have another. We'll have another.
Yes, but it's true, right? Like, it's like blackface. It's like, you know, you have this character that has black skin, but nothing about them has changed, you know? And I like the NBA 2K series for what it's doing now. Now, granted, it's over the top sometimes, but I really think that it's really, gamers love that they're able to create somebody that looks like them, you know, not only has like the skin tone, but they can get the lip fullness to the right. They can get their nose right, their cheekbones right, the hair is right. Even with the mannerisms, like how somebody walks, like, you know, I remember, you know, I set up like a little experiment when I, you know, and, with some students before, you know, the students were just really like amazed at just the customization of what they could do to be able to create somebody that looks like them. And even, I'm even thinking about like the customization, like even around to be able to create, you know, they're doing a lot better going beyond just like man and woman. You know, we've got like non-binary characters and trans characters. So the gaming world is getting like a lot better, right? But they were forced to, like, we had to keep our foot on their necks, you know, for them to have to act right and do right. Because, you know, if we just left them to their own devices, you know, they would not have done any of this at all. But it's very important. I think it's very important that folks can see themselves represented, you know, because that's part of like the empowerment process, you know, like if you can see yourself, you can see it, you can believe it, you know, you can do it. And I just think that it's very important. Now for us, you know, it's not a requirement. I just think that, you know, because think about, you know, Amber, you know, I think me and you are, you know, pretty close to like the same like generations where we didn't see all of this, you know, we didn't see like a lot of diversity. We really had to work for it and go look for it, you know, because, but these young folks today, you know, they've got it. But there was a fight, you know, I want to make sure that they realize that, you know, we fought really hard, you know, for them to be able to turn on Netflix and be able to see, you know, young black girls in lead roles, you know, people.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I mean, I love watching like Jingle Jangle. Like, I watch Jingle Jangle like every day.
I watched it like multiple times.
Right. I mean, it's just awesome, you know? So it's very important. Yeah. I please send me the link to that episode. I would love to listen to that. Yeah.
What you said, it really resonated with me because, like even like when I was like a little younger than this, there was like this kind of gap. Where there wasn't really like BIPOC characters of color not really represented correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of games like Skyrim, like Minecraft, who've kind of like their like if they were like released in like the 90s, they'd be very like groundbreaking because it's not, these games are like avatar customization is no longer centering.
Yeah.
Whiteness, maleness, and I was gonna say masculinity, and then I said maleness, but it's not centering, like these white male ideals, now it's starting to like expand the horizon. I think that's really important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And folks like you, and I appreciate folks like you who are making sure, you know, to bringing up these issues and staying on their neck as we have to, you know, to make sure these folks keep acting right.
So then a lot of your work centers the voices of women, specifically BIPOC women. Why is it important to have more women and BIPOC folks develop games?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. I think that goes to, back to what we were just talking about how we had generations of like the same old thing over and over again, right? You know, we have the same old thing over and over again because it's the same old people at the table just creating the same old nonsense over and over again, right? And I think when we have like more diverse like perspectives and we have more diverse, you know, voices like at the table, at the ideation phase, at the creation phase, then we come up with like a lot more complex, like nuanced characters that really benefit us all, right? I'm even thinking about I was watching Bridgerton. Did you all watch Bridgerton?
We have not watched it just yet, but we will. It's on our list. It's on our list.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, I won't give any spoilers, but you know, Bridgerton really is like a story of like whiteness, but it's like complex whiteness, right? It's not flat whiteness. Like, I just think that what Shonda Rhimes did and like the writing team behind that did was like just fascinating because these are diverse people like behind the scenes. Like, think about like in the 90s, you know, you knew the template of movie, you know, what kind of hero you were going to get, you know, the story. It was boring. Right? And so I just even think that us like bringing us to the table like was just like necessary to bring life back to Hollywood and to bring life back to, you know, or Netflix or Hollywood. I don't want to center Hollywood because Hollywood's not the center of like the media universe anymore. But, you know, I just think it's just, you know, fascinating that we have like all these like diverse creators. Like, you know, think about like the Issa Rae's like of the world, you know, like how her creativity, you know, would have been stifled because nobody would give her a chance because she just didn't fit the template of what they thought a creator should be, right?
Right? Awkward Black Girl changed everything.
Yes!
It is amazing.
Right? And we actually talked about how these Black creators are leaving the doors open for now others to come in. So, like, we wouldn't have had Black Lady Sketch Show if we wouldn't have had Insecure or Awkward Black Girl.
So. Absolutely.
Black Lady Courtroom.
What's that one? I missed it, Naima. What'd you say?
I said Black Lady Courtroom. It's from one of the episodes.
Absolutely. Like, we just have, like, all this, like, amazingness. And it's so different. Like, just even think about how, I mean, you know, I'm thinking about like the 90s, you know, that is like my childhood, like really like the 90s, right? So I'm just thinking about like all the diehards, all the Lethal Weapons. It's the same template over and over and over again. And just think about even like among like, you know, Black women creators, how different it is, you know, the different things that they create. Like, it's not even like one template, right? And I think that might be the thing that I think people are like the most shocked about, like the range in which we operate, first off, because we have to, but second off, because we're just that dope and we're just that like amazing. And I think that's one of the reasons we have been kept out of these rooms and these spaces for so long, because people get intimidated by our greatness, right? We can't walk around and be mediocre in this world, right? So even the most mediocre among us is still greater than their best, you know? I can't nobody tell me different. Like, ain't nobody gonna tell me different. But I really think that it's really important that we, you know, we've seen a lot of progressive strides, like within like, you know, that world, right? Within music and like movies and TV. Gaming's a bit slow, right? I don't think we've seen as many strides and changes in gaming as we should, because I think gaming is mostly like a hidden world, right? It's really the space that people don't understand. People still think it's just like, you're just a bunch of kids, you know, in the space. They don't realize like, this is like the number one, like entertainment outlet now, like with the gaming world. People don't understand streaming. And I think because of like all of the misunderstandings around it, like people aren't taking it like serious enough. And I think Gamergate was like the thing that kind of brought gaming to like a national and international conversation, but I hate it was so negative. You know, we had to, and I think that Gamergate, like for a lot of folks, it just confirmed that this was like a space of bad actors and toxic people. And then a lot of people just didn't take it serious again. Right. You know, but I think, you know, we've got some spaces of like where people are continuing to work, you know, Black Girl Gamers, you know, Black Girl Code, Tanya to Pass and I Need Diverse Games, you know, Khalif Adams and Spawn on Me. You know, we've got like a lot of folks, you know, who are doing like a lot of great things, like, you know, these Black creators, you know, Black, Indigenous and other folks of color, you know, who are like these creators where they're changing the narrative and trying to get like the narrative like around gaming for people to take it like seriously. You know, I think a lot of it really just goes back to, I'm thinking about the last time that gaming was like at the national conversation. It was probably like when Hillary Clinton was talking about Mortal Kombat and she was trying to get like Mortal Kombat like off the shelves, you know, because everybody was just like, oh, these games are the game, you know. And then they also, you know, solidified gaming and its connection to like school shootings, you know, in really like significant ways. So I think people just don't even realize what the gaming world even looks like and entails. So, you know, we're still having like basic conversations. We're still trying to just get folks to take gaming seriously. So it's hard to like elevate conversations. Whereas like, you know, TV and film and cinema, you know, these have been, you know, mainstream public psyche, you know, for, you know, since the silent era of like, you know, the 20s, you know. So, you know, people have, you know, been taking, you know, this medium, you know, pretty serious, like for like a long time. So gaming's the new kid on the block. So it's got to go through all of those cultural woes before we can elevate and progress and have like really serious conversations that we need to have.
Yeah, like I really connected with that because like every time I will watch like an old movie or like an old cartoon, it'll be like centered around whiteness. Even if it's not centered around like masculinity, there's always like whiteness. And even if there is cultural characters, those characters are based around stereotypes and based around like things that like aren't always true to us. Like having like BIPOC people and like women opening those doors and kind of breaking the mold is a really great thing.
Absolutely, Norma.
And then I want to ask, why do more people need to challenge injustices through digital means? And how can gaming platforms and game dev companies collaborate with activists to build more equitable spaces?
Ooh, that's a fantastic question. I think this question, you know, really goes back to, you know, what I was saying about so many people not taking like the gaming space seriously. And so a lot of people don't even realize that these are significant and powerful, you know, platforms and spaces where these conversations need to be happening. But I've seen it like in my own work, you know, like, so for instance, you know, I was following, you know, a group of women who were gaming in Xbox Live, and they were gaming together when they learned about the officer that was let off, the officer Pantaleo, the person that killed Rakia Boyd. Like I was in the room where when they found out, you know, this news, and it was their reaction to it was immediate. You know, when they realized, you know, they said, you know, I remember hearing one of the women's voices, you know, very clear. You know, she said, you know, they let this MF-er go. And immediately, you know, she did some micro mobilization of where she tried to organize and like rally folks like in the area so people could show up at the courthouse. They wanted to get to the courthouse like immediately, you know, in Chicago, you know, to make sure that they knew that we were upset about this and the community wasn't going to have it. And I think it was like at that moment where she realized that there just wasn't going to be that much energy put behind a Black woman who was a victim of police violence. You know, because she compared that rally to the rally of Freddie Gray's rally and, you know, Eric Garner's rally. And she said, you know, people show up like for Black men, but we just can't get them to show up like, you know, for Black women. And I think, you know, that was like, you know, the lead up. That was like the precursor to like, you know, to the hashtag say her name. And I just thought that, you know, being in that space, like, you know, wherever, you know, she was able to, she came back, you know, vented like her feelings and how she felt. And she became exhausted, you know, because she had been doing some activism and micro mobilization, you know, for several years. And she just couldn't get folks to like rally around, you know, some of the issues, especially related to like Black women and Black girls, like in the neighborhood. And she was like exhausted. She just didn't understand why. And then she went to her stream. She was stream. She started to stream shortly after that. You know, she started to incorporate streaming technology. She was streaming on Mixer. And I remember one time, you know, she wanted to, she did like a little fundraiser to raise funds for somebody's burial costs. I can't remember who, but somebody came into her chat and was basically said, you know, this isn't the space for that. You know, this is supposed to be gaming. You know, why are you always taking this so seriously? Why are you always, you know, basically just doing the thing that, you know, trolls do, right? And then, you know, she said she was just committed. So she said, you know, as long as I have a voice and I have a platform, I'm going to advocate for Black women and girls out here. And, you know, and she said, if you don't like it, you can go. And it was so fascinating. It was bizarre. It was really wild and toxic, actually. But this person actually, you know, encouraged other people to leave her chat and to leave her stream and to not support and like donate. And then basically, you know, had people come over to his stream and he wasn't doing nothing but just being stupid. You know, I'm just like, this is, and then she just couldn't understand, you know, well, she does understand it because she understands, you know, there's just like no investment, you know, mostly, especially like in Black and Indigenous women and girls. But she was like, you know, here's just like another example of, you know, like, you know, people like mobilizing like their followers like to troll me and to be toxic. And then the platform does nothing. Like there was no protection behind that, you know? And so, you know, I think, you know, if it's hard to get these big name folks to on board with activism. I'm not sure if you're familiar with a streamer named Ninja. Ninja just recently said something crazy. He said it's not his responsibility to teach his followers like about race or racism, right? He said,
is Ninja a person, a BIPOC person or a white?
No. Look up Ninja. Look okay, up Ninja like right now. You got the internet up? Look up Ninja.
Yes, we do. We do. Googling. We are. This is a collaborative experience and we want to encourage those who will be listening to also do the same.
Look up Ninja and you could probably go to Ninja and click on the
news. Oh, I know Ninja.
Yeah, you know Ninja. Yeah, you know Ninja. He said, where's the one? He's always talking crazy. I'm trying to find the article where he said, but he said, let's see, race, Ninja and race. Oh, I can't find that article. I'll find it and send it to you. I want to make sure you see it. But basically,
we'll add it to the show notes.
Okay. Fantastic. But you know, he basically said it wasn't his responsibility and he wasn't going to use his platform in that manner. But the unfortunate thing is that not more than what, like 7 months ago, you know, this summer, you know, when everybody was issuing their statements around like Black Lives Matter, you know, and solidarity around, you know, the death of George Floyd. And, you know, he was one of the ones that, you know, said, hey, Black Lives Matter. Right. So he did it when it was cool. But, you know, here's like another time where he was just like, you know, I'm not going to do it. Like, it's so incongruent, you know. Like, if you could say Black Lives Matter, then the race should matter to you, but that just lets you know that people just don't actually care, or they don't actually even know, like, what they're talking about, right? You know, so I'm just thinking about, you know, the question that you're asking, that they don't care because we're the ones that are being harmed. We're the ones that are being harmed in the digital spaces. You know, I'm thinking about, like, Black folks and Black women in particular are most subject to, like, the punishments of these digital spaces. We get banned the most. You know, we get banned at disproportionate rates. You know, when we're doing something, you know, people will report us and, you know, it'll bring, like, the attention of the internet police to us. And then, you know, we get banned. And so I think, you know, it's imperative on these companies to really think about, like, the protections and the lack of protections that, you know, so many Black and Indigenous folks, you know, that we don't have in these spaces. And it's hard to get these people to care, right? You know, so I've tried to have conversations with industry folks and, you know, different kind of like influencer kind of types of people. And they really are so, because they've monetized their sites, they have just commodified their products. You know, they're just trying to make money at this point, you know? So Ninja is not going to invest in, you know, any kind of content that will be controversial to his followers, you know, his racist followers, right? Mm. You know, so they like when he says the N-word on his stream, you know, they like when he says that he'll never play with women because women aren't good at gaming or whatever reason, you know, they love that. So, and I think that, you know, if that's like the template and that's like the thing that people are aspiring to be, you know, we've got our work cut out for us, you know, because I don't even know how to cut through that kind of ignorance, you know, willful ignorance and, you know, to get people to even, see like a counterpoint and a counterposition, right? It's not, I mean, it's wrong. I don't even, you know, I hate to even like elevate his position as one that has value or merit or any kind of weight in, you know, because it's garbage. His positions are like garbage. He's a garbage individual. He's trash. I'm going to go ahead and just say it. I want to say it as publicly and loudly as I can. Here, folks. But, you know, here we are elevating Ninja as like one of the faces of like, you know, the sports of the gaming world of like esports and streaming. Whereas you have an individual like Sonic Fox, you know, a queer, black masculine person who is amazing and has a great platform, like elevates people. But just because he has like a queer identity and he's like a black man and, you know, he's like a furry individual or whatever, you know, like people just don't think that he is like one. I think they actually use they them pronouns. Excuse me. I'm sorry for misgendering Sonic Fox. But I think that, you know, people just don't look at Sonic Fox as a person who could, you know, be the face of gaming. The esports world did a really ugly thing in conjunction with ESPN, right? So they had Ninja on the cover of the ESPN magazine, and he became the face of the esports world, the streaming world, right? But that same time, during that same year, Sonic Fox was the person who had won like the award for like Gamer of the Year. So in the gaming world, it would have made sense to elevate Sonic Fox, but that was just incongruent with what, you know, these folks think, you know, should be the person who should be like the face of esports and streaming. So we have these sports institutions like Sports Illustrated and ESPN that continue to elevate, you know, white masculinity as like the template and the norm, you know, in a world that is very diverse. And, you know, they just couldn't fathom putting like Sonic Fox up there. So Sonic Fox could be the face of that. I hope you all know who Sonic Fox is. I want to make sure you all know who Sonic Fox is. Okay. Wonderful. I love this human being, such a force in the gaming world. But you know, they don't give Sonic Fox, you know, the respect that they deserve. And it's really unfortunate. So to get back to the question, I want to make sure I answer you like the question. People aren't invested in creating equitable spaces. Because, you know, going back to that thing, you know, that means they feel that something would have to be taken away from them, that they would lose some power, that something, they would have to give up something in order to give it to, you know, black, indigenous, you know, folks of color, you know, in order to create these equitable spaces. But they're not invested in us. So they're not invested in making sure that the spaces, you know, are safe for us.
I was like, this is amazing. Like, I really resonated with what you said, and I thought that was really true. Like, even though spaces are getting more like inclusive, there's still like racism, there's still sexism, and there's still like inequality within spaces. And I think that people don't understand a lot of that because they think, oh, it's so inclusive, or yay, absolutely, gaming, everyone can do it. But people, there's still inequality and what was the word I was about to use? There's still inequality within the space, and there's still like doors we need to open and barriers we need to break.
Absolutely. I just wanted to also jump in a lot of the discussions that I have about gaming and civility and incivility and inequities online. You know, a lot of that conversation points toward the space. We need to build better games. We need to build better. It's like, we actually need to like build better people. Right. And like the principles that, and you stated this at the beginning of the interview, which I was like, yes, the principles that people hold with them, they bring them with them to that space. Absolutely. So, you know, hopefully gaming organizations can begin to think about like, how do we help shape behavior online, also building for safety and equity, but influence human behavior as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then our next question is, you write about gaming and video games, which really connected with me and inspired me to reach out. Who's your favorite feminist thinker, writer, or coder, or etc.? Because yeah, there's more than like thinkers, writers, and coders.
Absolutely. Oh, I love this question. Oh my goodness. Like, there's so many. I don't know if I could like pick one. Maybe how about what I'll do? I'll give you maybe like a top three of folks who influence my own thinking about games. Can I do that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I would say my top three. Audre Lorde would have to be up there. I also Kimberly Crenshaw would have to be up there. And oh my gosh, this is so tough. This is so tough. Maybe Gloria Anzaldúa. I hope I didn't pronounce her name wrong. I always feel like I pronounced it wrong. Gloria Anzaldúa. And so she's like an indigenous Chicano like scholar. But these are like, you know, the people that I learned feminism from, right? So I didn't learn, you know, feminism. You know, a lot of people, you know, are critical of like feminism because it's like a white feminism, right? But I think I came into feminism really from Black indigenous Latinx, you know, scholars, you know, these folks who were thinking about their intersectional lives and their intersectional world of being Black or brown and being queer, you know, being women, being in a space where, you know, Black men or brown men, you know, the men dominated, you know, so or machismo, or, you know, these women who were working in like the civil rights movements and who, you know, couldn't advocate or speak for themselves because the men were expecting them to just cook and to make copies, where, you know, these women were actually like the backbone of like the movements, you know. So I think that they were the ones, you know, who really like influenced like a lot of my thinking, you know, Toni Morrison's work, you know, I love reading, you know, this, I mean, so many, like I knew I wasn't going to be able to do like this question. I remember looking at it and thinking, oh, there's no way I could do it. But I just really want to just highlight, you know, the, you know, Black feminist, you know, thinkers, you know, the Chicana thinkers, the indigenous, you know, thinkers who were really, you know, central to, you know, the foundations of like intersectionality, right? You know, the women of the Combahee River Collective, you know, who, you know, really let us know that, you know, our class conditions, our gender conditions, our racial conditions, like all of these things like work in tandem. You know, there is like no one form of like oppression that, you know, like outweighs like the other, you know. And if we think about like the least among us, then, you know, would improve the conditions of us all. So I think I would say those are the folks who are like influenced me like the most.
Well, you're getting all the snaps and claps over here. We were just like, yes.
You belong at our kitchen table.
Yes. I love it.
Who are you talking
about? This question kind of feeds into our next question, which is, who is a feminist thinker, writer, or coder that you wish everyone knew about?
Oh my gosh, I love this question so much. There is this French woman. Her name is Muriel Trami, Muriel Trami. So Tramis. I know it's not Tramis. I don't know the French pronunciation, but I think she's like the first Black woman game designer. And nobody knows her. Nobody knows her name. And whenever I was introduced to her, I'm like, you know, why don't we know her? Why don't we talk about her? Why is she not like in, like, think about like all the documentaries we had like about gaming. Why is she not present? You know, I mean, you know, so I think, you know, it's I want to make sure that people like know her, hashtag say her name. You know, she's an amazing, you know, person who's like contributed greatly, you know, to like the world of like gaming and design and tech. And most people have no idea, you know, who she is. So I want to make sure that people know who she is. Hashtag say her name. Yeah.
Yo, we're adding her to the show notes to make sure that people know her name.
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
But sort of to dip from that subject, but to stay sort of similar, do you have any advice for any Black girl gamers and coders?
I do. Oh my gosh. So I remember early on, there were a lot of people that told me that gaming is not like an avenue of serious academic inquiry and I should pick something else. I didn't listen to them, right? So I don't want to tell people not to listen to advice of like advisors and mentors, but I do want to tell them to follow your heart. So if your heart is telling you to do something that maybe your advisors or mentors, you know, are saying otherwise, I want folks to have the confidence to just pursue what they know is right in their gut and to pursue the thing that they know that they have passion for, because that passion is going to carry you through everything. You know, whenever you get rejections, whenever you, you know, don't get that job, or whenever you don't get that award, or whenever you don't get something, you know, you can hold on to your passion. And that's going to be the thing that sustains you, that you know that the work that you're doing is valuable and important, and that you have significant contributions to the world. Like, the world may not see it at that time, but I think that if you just hold on, you know, to your beliefs and your hope and your faith, and just to know that what you're doing is the thing that makes sense for you, to keep it going. And I think, because we're told so at so many points in our lives, you know, from the world tells us, our families tell us, you know, people, our friends might tell us, you know, especially when we're in these spaces that are occupied mostly by men and by white men, especially when you have like folks like us who are in these spaces, you know, we are the ones out of place, you know, they think we don't belong. But, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, we stand our ground and we stay, you know, steadfast and unmovable, and we let them know that we belong there too.
Well, you're definitely making a really big difference. But as we wrap up, where can people find your work and what do you have coming up?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking this. So I think, you know, I think I've been slanging my most recent book in these streets, Intersectional Tech. I think Intersectional Tech is my book that just came out like in September. So it was a fun book to write. You know, I had a lot of fun. There was a lot of awesome stories, you know, that I was able to tell, you know, in that book. And so I would say that's probably my most recent work. And I do have some projects that are coming up, but you know, COVID has put a lot of that stuff on hold, you know, so, and that's all right. You know, I'll get back to those projects, you know, in a time that it makes sense. But if folks want to see more of my work, you know, they can Google me, you know, and then go to the website. You know, my books are on, you know, they're on all the sites. And so, but if you just Google my name, you know, a lot of stuff like will pop up.
Okay, that is really good to know, but I am really excited to get my hands on this new book of yours. I was like in the back, like, Mom, can we get this book? And she's like, like that.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
We just want to thank you so much, Dr. Gray, because literally this child has literally lit up since picking up the first book of yours that came into our home. And so I just want to thank you so much for inspiring her, especially during this time of COVID, when, you know, we're indoors and school and sports are over for us and all kinds of things have been eliminated. She is super inspired by the things that you've said. And so I as a mom, want to thank you just so much.
Absolutely. Thank you all. I appreciate y'all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
If you enjoyed this conversation, you can follow Dr. Gray on social media at Kishana Gray. That's at KISHONNAGRAY. We've linked her website, www.kishanagray.com, in the show notes so that you can find all of her awesome books, lectures, and insights. The first step toward understanding inequity is acknowledging that it exists, and then maybe your own experience isn't the only available experience out there. Maybe your experience isn't even the only experience that people want to live. So how do we center the humanity of others in spaces, digital and physical? What is our responsibility toward building the capacity to hold space for ourselves while also holding space for the suffering of others? Become a student. We challenge families and classrooms to dig into intersectionality and intersectional tech. Start off with Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw's TED Talk, which is linked in the show notes. And then check out the groundbreaking work that Dr. Gray is doing to bring awareness to the inequity and harassment on gaming platforms and social media as it relates to how